Happy New Year. You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2017 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Akko's Ride. When Akko Abdulrahman bought a used bulletproof BMW in 2014, it was the Kurdish soldier's way of standing out from the crowd, not to mention protecting himself. 2 years later, when ISIS invaded Kirkuk and began slaughtering civilians, Abdulrahman and his car made all the difference. Jeffrey E. Stern reports. Photographs by Singiz Yar. Opening photo, fire, when ready. Akko Abdulrahman in his bulletproof BMW E32 750i security vehicle in northern Iraq. The oil-rich city of Kirkuk in northern Iraq was quiet the evening before the surprise attack by ISIS last October. On the city's outskirts, a young Kurdish Peshmerga soldier named Akko Abdulrahman parked his bulletproof BMW outside his house. The front line was far, more than 100 miles away in Mosul, where the American-backed coalition had just launched the biggest operation yet against the Islamic State. But in Kirkuk, there were few signs of ISIS. Soldiers traveled to fight elsewhere. The provincial governor had left to go on holiday. It was the weekend. But before dawn on Friday, October 21st, 2016, more than 100 ISIS fighters passed through a gap in Kirkuk's defenses and began moving, unnoticed, toward the city center. Akko Abdulrahman didn't know it yet, but the eyes of an entire city would soon be on him and his car. Berish Motorenwerk introduced its high-security line of luxury automobiles nearly 40 years ago with the philosophy that the best way to protect your cargo was to call no attention to it. A BMW assembly line in Dingolfing, Germany, was re-engineered with the special machinery needed to form ballistic-grade paneling and high-melting-point ultra-strong metals into the shape of the company's standard models. The cars were designed to look like any other BMW. In the days when the Bader-Meinhof gang was terrorizing wealthy capitalists, it was the perfect conveyance for an executive seeking safety and discretion. When Akko Abdulrahman, then 30, bought a used BMW E32 750i security vehicle, his intention was the opposite of the one BMW had envisioned. Nothing Akko does is safe or discreet. If he offers you one of his French cigarettes, he lunges forward with it. He drinks a cappuccino in three gulps. He listens to Kurdish rap music and likes it loud. His presence is one of urgent motion. Even his beard is shaped into an angular prominence that suggests direction. When Akko bought the BMW, the first thing he did was put a forest pattern camouflage decal right on the hood. Camouflage that he hoped would make the car stand out rather than blend in. He wanted it looking martial. Akko had been raised on stories of slaughter. He was born in 1984, and among his first memories was hearing how Saddam Hussein had gassed a village of Akko's own people, the Kurds, killing 5,000 civilians. Even as a child, he had a hair-trigger sensitivity to examples of powerful people punishing the powerless. He felt Kurds had been victimized by Sunni Arabs, by Shia militias, by the Iraqi army. He hated Al-Qaeda. When elements of Al-Qaeda morphed into ISIS, he hated ISIS. For Akko, revenge was a cause, a calling. He was drawn to conflict and to weapons. And in the part of the world where he lives, there is almost always a fight to be had. At age 15, he joined the Peshmerga, the ones who faced death. He was wild on the front line, walking down roads without cover and slicing bomb wires without a bomb suit or even a flak jacket. At 17, he got his tattoos, three faint dots around one eye, a common Iraqi design, and a scrawl on his arm that says life is torture. Soon after the American military came to northern Iraq, in the course of the 2003 invasion and occupation, Akko trained with them. By his own account, he killed a man for the first time in 2007, and by now he has killed 100 men, maybe more. Once, he says, he beheaded 4 Al-Qaeda terrorists. In general, the killing has gotten easier. Beheadings, he admits, would never be easy. It was a dangerous life, and after he was wounded in an ambush while driving home one day, Akko decided he needed a bulletproof car. He was at peace with the idea of dying in battle, but he didn't want to die en route to one. A friend of Akko's owned an armored 1989 BMW that he had bought in Baghdad and brought to Kirkuk. The friend said it had belonged to Israeli intelligence. Akko assumed it was really American intelligence. BMW, citing a commitment to maximum discretion and anonymity, will not say who its clients in Baghdad may have been. The friend offered to sell the car for $10,000. Akko started saving in earnest, taking construction jobs when he and his Peshmerga brothers weren't on duty. In 2014, he took possession. It had a V12 engine, an aramid fiber synthetic layer, and polycarbonate glass windows that didn't go down very far, but would stop bullets. Checkpoint. At midnight, ISIS fighters leached into Kirkuk and moved toward the center of the city, then split up and headed for separate targets. One group took control of a bridge and cut off a neighborhood that many security personnel lived in. Another took up positions surrounding a police station. The idea seemed to be that when the attack began, police and security forces would rush to their station, and ISIS fighters would pick them off as they arrived. A third group surrounded the governor's headquarters. A fourth targeted a government office building that stood next to a jail where ISIS fighters have often been held. This fourth group soon split up. One team occupied the Jihad Hotel, which provided a nearly 360-degree vantage point over the city center. Another approached an old synagogue on the citadel across a river from the tower. The third scaled the office tower's wall and entered the compound. Using a police radio, ISIS announced that it now controlled the building. 60 miles to the east of Kirkuk, the governor's phone beeped with a message. Najmuddin Karim, a physician by training, had been a light sleeper ever since his nights on call as a neurosurgery resident at George Washington University Hospital in Washington, D.C. In 1981, after the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan, Reagan and his entourage were taken to that hospital. Karim was a surgeon who assisted the team that saved the life of Press Secretary Jim Brady. The information in the phone message was sparse. Gunshots had been heard around the city. Karim considered, then rejected the notion that it might be a celebration. There was no political party having an anniversary. None of the favorite soccer teams were playing. In a security convoy, Karim raced back to the city. Akko, at his home on the outskirts of Kirkuk, got his own call an hour after the governor did. It was Abbas, a friend and fellow Peshmerga fighter. Next photos, local hero. Akko, outside a house he helped move a displaced family to in Tuzkarmatu. Akko and a ranking commander survey a Peshmerga frontline position southeast of Kirkuk, Iraq. And road warrior, Akko and his BMW outside his house in Tuzkarmatu, Iraq. Akko felt a surge of excitement, then doubt. Kirkuk was secure, wasn't it? The fighting was supposed to be in Mosul. Still, he wasn't going to let a chance go by. He took two assault rifles, a Kalashnikov and a G3, and a machine gun, out to the BMW. The rifles would sit next to him, and the machine gun would stay in the trunk. It was his PKM, like the one Rambo uses. Too big to shoot from inside the car, anyway. Akko had 5 magazines on a belt around his waist, and an additional 3,000 rounds in backpacks. He lit a Gitan cigarette and pulled out onto the road. Akko drove angrily. He had recently watched an ISIS propaganda video which showed Peshmerga soldiers being pulled into a city street in jumpsuits, bound and blindfolded. Civilians were made to shoot each of the prisoners in the head, then to keep shooting even after the bodies were curled on the ground. Orange commas jumping with each shot. Akko put on a CD with his Kurdish rap and cranked up the volume. It was still dark, and the inside of the car was thick with smoke because the air conditioning was broken and the security glass would go down only a few centimeters. His first stop was to pick up Abbas on the way downtown. By now, ISIS fighters had pushed deep into Kirkuk. So when Akko and Abbas arrived, the city seemed deserted. The sun was just coming up. The roads were empty. Akko saw police cars outside a small police station, and he stopped there to ask what was going on. The station was empty. It looked as if the policemen had abandoned the post in a hurry. Then Akko and Abbas heard gunfire, small, tightly packed burst, which Akko knew to be weapons set to automatic. The gunfire sounded as if it was coming from the other side of a riverbed. They got back in the car, and Akko turned down the music so he could track the gunshots. The sound led them to what appeared to be a checkpoint on a bridge, where armed men stood alongside police patrol cars. Something obviously was not right. The men at the checkpoint were not wearing police uniforms. In the dim morning light, from several hundred yards out and closing, Akko began to make out what looked like foreign clothing, the baggy Afghan-style shirts that Akko associated with terrorists. And unlike most policemen in Kirkuk, these men all had beards. Then he understood. They were ISIS fighters who had stolen the patrol cars and were trying to divide one part of the city from another. Akko knew they had already seen the BMW. He decided to breach the checkpoint. He flashed his lights 3 times as though communicating with the fighters. Then he hit the gas pedal. The ISIS fighters didn't seem to know what to make of the luxury sedan hurtling toward them. They didn't even raise their weapons as Akko flew past. With the checkpoint behind them, Akko slowed and again listened for gunfire. He had the palpable sense of being within ISIS-held territory. He thought he caught little glimpses of it. A flash of motion on a rooftop was an ISIS sniper shifting in his hiding place. Then he saw bodies, 10 people on the side of the road, maybe more, lying next to a few stalled cars. Some were dead. Some were wounded. Next to them, a young woman in black stood upright. Locking eyes, she screamed at him as he drove past, screamed about her children and about the family members dead and wounded at her feet, and about the people in the cars around her. Akko felt something begin to stir. His preoccupation with fighting ISIS was displaced for a moment by an impulse to save those people on the street. He made a U-turn. Second wind. What Akko did next caught the attention of local Kurdish news channels and TV stations, and eventually even a few international outlets. After seeing these reports, I traveled to Kirkuk this summer to find Akko and to hear the full details of his story. The first person he came upon was a taxi driver, middle-aged, balding, and chubby. He had been hit in the neck through the driver's side window. Akko pulled the BMW up to the man and positioned it so the car's armor would serve as a shield from oncoming fire. Abbas jumped out, using his open door for protection on his flank. He pulled the man from the taxi and into the BMW, sitting him upright. Akko turned in his seat and reached for the man's neck. He worried his fingers through the blood, checking for a pulse. There was nothing. The man was dead. Akko did not want to leave the taxi driver behind. For ISIS, bodies were opportunities for propaganda, mutilated, celebrated, filmed. He pulled out and accelerated, racing north through the ISIS-controlled neighborhood until he reached Kirkuk's biggest public emergency hospital. After dropping off the body, Akko and Abbas returned to the same neighborhood for more of the dead and wounded. Each time, they repeated the maneuver, forming the car's body and the open door into a bulletproof V around the victim. For those hit in extremities, Akko tied tourniquets. For the others, all he could do was haul them into the car and drive as fast as possible. Akko and Abbas went back and forth to the hospital throughout the morning, 2 times, 6 times, 8 times. From that one spot near the woman in black, he took in 15 people. 10 were dead by the time he pulled into the hospital. Soon, Akko's deliveries were generating special requests. People at the hospital recognized the man who kept coming back with more dead and wounded, and began asking if he could check on this friend, that relative. Everyone had a stake. By now, there was fighting all over Kirkuk. After 8 trips, Akko and Abbas needed a break. They bought apples and sat in the car to eat and smoke. But people wouldn't leave them alone. Throughout the city, victims needed help. Akko told the people coming to his window that he was too tired. They could take the car if they wanted. No one took him up on the offer. They wanted the car, but they wanted the driver with it. In early afternoon, Abbas picked up a call from a friend trapped in the southern part of Kirkuk, a construction worker who had slept in the house he was working on the night before, and who woke to find himself in the middle of the siege. The man was pinned down. This meant that rescuing him was also a chance to fight. Akko got a second wind. Driving south, back toward the outskirts of the city, he and Abbas honed in on the shooter's position by tracking the sound of gunfire and found him well positioned in an upper window at the corner of a block. Akko saw a nearby house he liked with a high roof and good lines of sight. He stopped the car, got out, and charged through the front door without knocking, Abbas right on his heels. He yelled in Arabic at the Arab family, "Don't be afraid," and found stairs up to the family's roof. From there he could see the shooter's position, but had a bad angle. He leapt to the next house, moving closer to the shooter, but still had no shot. He lowered himself off the roof and dropped to the ground, then ran to press himself up against a wall near the shooter, but still didn't have a good angle. He reached for a cigarette, remembered he left them in the car, and got an idea. He and Abbas got back in the BMW. Akko swung around the block and then accelerated straight toward the shooter's position, stopping only when he was almost directly underneath the window. Abbas cracked the passenger door open and held his Kalashnikov rifle in the narrow V between the door and the windshield, firing single shots with a slow rhythm. The return fire dented the paneling and left impressions on the windshield, but didn't penetrate. As Abbas kept the shooter occupied, Akko focused on the muzzle flashes coming from the window. Then he stubbed out his cigarette, switched his fire selector to full automatic, opened the door, jumped out, and squeezed. Before the shooter could shift his attention away from the passenger side, Akko had fired 30 rounds of electric red tracer bullets at the window. The house went silent. Kirkuk was now in chaos. ISIS was killing people everywhere. The attackers had detonated 3 suicide bombs at a power station near the oil fields and had killed 15 workers there. In the heart of the city, they had slipped into houses and high buildings surrounding the most strategic sites. Anyone who hadn't been awakened by gunfire and explosions woke to ISIS on mosque loudspeakers, announcing that Kirkuk was now part of the Islamic State. Reinforcements coming to help with a counterattack were running into their own troubles. A Peshmerga unit west of the city was under fire. A counterterrorism unit coming from the east drove into an ISIS ambush. The U.S.-run ISIS strike center in Baghdad was hamstrung. It was coordinating air assets all over Iraq, manned and unmanned, land and carrier-based, and could both conduct surveillance and mount an attack. But it had been monitoring a 24-hour feed of Mosul. There'd been no reason to pay much attention to Kirkuk. In any case, once ISIS had infiltrated the city, tactical air support was no longer an option. From the air, it was almost impossible to distinguish ISIS positions from civilian ones. Akko's cell phone rang again. It was a friend calling from downtown. "Akko, where are you?" "I'm at home, sleeping," he said, weakly trying for humor. "Kirkuk is under attack. This would be a really good day to use your car." "Doesn't anyone else have an armored car?" "We're on the bridge, near the old directorate of police. I'll give you anything. Just come here and help these people." Akko swung the BMW around. He passed the ancient citadel and then crossed a bridge over the river. This placed him on a stretch of roadway that had just become a major front in the battle for the city. He stopped the car. Abbas took out another apple, and Akko lit another cigarette. They took stock of the situation. ISIS fighters had holed up in the Jihad Hotel, a quarter of a mile away. They held a commanding, elevated vantage point, and from this one location were able to paralyze that central neighborhood. Security forces had begun to make their way into Kirkuk and had some military vehicles at their disposal, but they weren't doing much with them yet. Far more important, in terms of resistance, were Kirkuk's ordinary citizens. The city was filled with volunteers and a few off-duty military men willing to fight. Many of these volunteers wanted to storm the hotel, but if they tried to advance on the building, they would be moving down a quarter mile of roadway, unprotected, and with no idea where in the hotel or in other buildings along the way ISIS fighters might be lurking. Akko had another idea. Using a technique he'd employed before, he would drive slowly down the road in his BMW, drawing fire and revealing the enemy. That would at least give the volunteers some useful intelligence. He pulled away and inched toward the hotel. A round struck the car on the passenger side, and Abbas yelled, "MFs won't even let me eat!" Akko said, "I swear to God, if it wasn't an armored car, your brain would be mixed with that apple." They bickered as Akko drew closer to the hotel. The next rounds came quick and close, a concentrated hailstorm that skittered across the windshield. One shot hit the car in a place Akko hadn't expected, in the driver's side door. That meant ISIS had a position not just in front in the hotel, but to his left near a bus depot. Akko yanked the car hard right, pulling away from the crossfire, circling the block, and eventually returning to the place he'd set out from, where the volunteers were about to advance. Akko made sure they knew about the bus depot and tried to persuade two of the volunteers to ride with him back to the hotel so they'd be protected at least part of the way. The two men seemed drunk on adrenaline. "What is ISIS?" one of them yelled, insisting he'd go on foot with his friend. "I'm not afraid of ISIS." A moment later, his head snapped, and the other man's neck opened up. A sniper had dispatched them both with a single round. The tide turns, but as the hours passed, the volunteers began to make progress. They took heavy casualties, but they drew closer to the hotel. Akko used the same maneuver he'd used earlier in the day, pulling up in front of the fallen and using the car's armor as a shield. The supply of wounded seemed endless. Word began to spread about the man in the BMW. His bullet-riddled car could be seen entering and exiting the frame on TV channels as news crews beamed footage of the fighting itself. By late afternoon, the tide had turned against ISIS. An all-female communist guerrilla unit from the PKK had come from the mountains nearby to help. Counter-terror units finally got into the city, and security forces retook the strategic locations. As volunteers made it inside the Jihad Hotel, they found wounded people who had been suffering for hours. One man they picked up just outside the hotel, with a hole in his chest, was hauled into Akko's car. Akko spoke to the man, trying to keep him alive as he raced to the hospital. He died in the back seat. By 5 p.m., the sun had slipped below the horizon, and Kirkuk was bathed in a gray-blue light. It never becomes totally dark in this city, because the flare stacks and the oil fields burn continuously. The fighting lasted 3 full days, but it was clear after the first day that ISIS would be defeated. Akko lost count of the people he saved and the bodies he retrieved, but toward the end of the day, he says a man approached him and said, "I've been counting for you. You've made 140 trips." Akko asked if he was joking. That couldn't be right. Later, local news reports about the man in the BMW put the number of lives saved at 70. Akko didn't know about that either. All he knew was that, when he had time to count, he found 123 bullet marks all over the BMW's body. He says he also knew that, throughout the day, Sunnis, Shiites, Kurds, Turkmen, and Christians had all been in his car. Among the people he had saved were those who belonged to groups he had hated, fought against, and shot at. The siege provided a brief moment of collaboration in Kirkuk. Akko has now dropped out of contact, as has Abbas, who was not available for comment on this story, in the face of another threat, this time in the form of the Iraqi military and Shia militias. After Kurds in Kirkuk voted overwhelmingly in a September referendum to secede from Iraq, the government in Baghdad removed Dr. Karim, who had supported the referendum vote, and then deployed Iraqi troops to Kirkuk to take over oil fields and a military base, and to block roads to other major Kurdish cities. One can imagine another call from a friend, Akko, this would be a really good time to use your car. To the manners born. If Britain's aristocracy has an answer to the Kardashian, it's the Manners sisters, Lady Violet, Lady Alice, and Lady Eliza, whose antics have been grist for the tabloids, as have the domestic arrangements of their parents, the 11th Duke and Duchess of Rutland, who continue to share the family seat, Belvoir Castle, both with new partners. Yet behind the Manners' disregard for certain proprieties, as James Reginato learns, is a deep commitment to their heritage. Photographs by Jonathan Becker. Opening photo, Sisters Act. Ladies Eliza, Alice, and Violet Manners in the Elizabeth Saloon of Belvoir Castle, their family home in Leicestershire, England. And a turret affair. Belvoir Castle, comprising 356 rooms, has been the family seat for the Earls and Dukes of Rutland since 1509. In 1066, their progenitor, Robert de Tosny, sailed across the English Channel from France with William the Conqueror and helped slaughter thousands of Anglo-Saxon troops at the Battle of Hastings, thus beginning the Norman conquest of England. Today, the Three Manners sisters are continuing the family tradition of storming the ramparts, but this time they are taking on the London social scene. In their rarefied world, the lively and alluring daughters of David and Emma Manners, their graces, the 11th Duke and Duchess of Rutland, Lady Violet, 24, Lady Alice, 22, and Lady Eliza, 20, just might be the equivalent of the Kardashians. There is little the busy sisters don't share with the world on their Instagram accounts, at Manners Violet, at Manners Alice, and at Eliza Manners. Amid an abundance of cleavage, bikinis, and louche pouts, there are shots of them participating in, among other activities, shooting, riding, skiing, yachting, car racing, scuba diving, skydiving, dancing, and safaris, and inevitably partying. The Bad Manners sisters of British high society, Duke of Rutland's leggy, loud, and frightfully naughty daughters, who make Downton's Crawley sisters look like angels, was the headline of a Daily Mail piece. Duke of Rutland's daughters infuriate neighbors with wild all-night parties, proclaimed the Telegraph. Their family seat is Belvoir Castle, a palatial, multi-towered and turreted 356-room behemoth on a 16,000-acre estate in Leicestershire, stocked with pictures by Van Dyck, Holbein, Poussin, and Reynolds. But the ruckus that landed them in the tabloids emanated from a 5-bedroom townhouse owned by the family in the Fulham district of London. The Pussy Palace, as it has been called, had become party central for the sisters and their circle of young aristocrats and offspring of the elite, which includes Lady Kitty Spencer, daughter of Earl Spencer, Lady Melissa Percy, daughter of the Duke of Northumberland, Lady Isabella Inskerr, daughter of the Duke of Roxburgh, Freddie and Sophia Hesketh, their father is the 3rd Baron Hesketh, Tara, Isaac and Otis Ferry, sons of Brian Ferry, and Gus Cameron, nephew of the former Prime Minister David Cameron. "I don't know what they do inside. It's like they have elephants in the house," complained Jackie Elliott, a resident of the heretofore tranquil block, to the Telegraph. Loud music, people coming and going very late, shouting, cars arriving, cars going. Her notes to Lady Violet drew mixed results. "Apologies on occasions, which never prevented callous repetition," said Elliot. Things blew up in the press when Vi posted online a photo of a letter Elliot had sent to the Duke, followed by cheeky commentary between Violet and her friends. Next photos, leave it to Belvoir. A Belvoir guest bedroom. A masked Eliza at her circus-themed 18th birthday party with Brother Lord Hugo in clown costume, 2015. Servants' bells. A Norman Heppel portrait of a 4-year-old David Manners, now the 11th Duke of Rutland, with his father, Charles, the 10th Duke of Rutland, 1963. The castle's grounds, designed by Capability Brown. The Duchess of Rutland in the upstairs gallery. And put up your duke, David Manners, the 11th Duke of Rutland. The servant's bell for the king's dressing room. The entrance to the duke's quarters. Old English hounds in their James Wyatt-designed kennels. A 1908 Renault acquired by the 9th Earl. And the state dining room. 5 years ago, the girls' parents, David, 58, and Emma, 54, generated headlines of their own. "The Duke of Rutland and I are separating, but we'll live together in our castle and have new partners." Duchess's remarkable response to her husband's infidelity was the lead in a September 2012 Daily Mail piece written by the Duchess herself. in which she revealed she had busted the Duke with two girlfriends over a 10-year stretch, which left her wretched, angry, and bitter. But she got over it and began a relationship of my own with a man who works on the estate. The gentleman in question, it was later discovered, is Phil Burt, 63, who had arrived at Belvoir in 2008 to manage the game shoot and went on to become the estate manager. The upstairs-downstairs romance prompted predictable comparisons to D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover. Today, domestic tranquility reigns at Belvoir, 120 miles from London. It helps to live under a 2.5-acre roof. There is no need for anybody to move out. The Duchess occupies the nursery wing, while the Duke resides in Shepherd's Tower, where he can entertain with his girlfriend, Andrea de Beau Webb, an elegant 50-something Brazilian national who occupies a property on the estate, as does Bert. Designer Nikki Haslam sizes up the situation. It's a very modern arrangement, yet very French 18th century at the same time. Following their 1992 wedding at Belvoir, the then Marquess and Marchioness of Granby settled into a Victorian manor house on the edge of the estate and started having children. Violet, born in 1993, followed by Alice in 1995, and Eliza in 1997. Then two boys, Charles in 1999 and Hugo in 2003. On January 1, 1999, the young family's cozy world was transformed upon the death at age 79 of David's father, Charles, the 10th Duke. Barbara Cartland once described him as absolutely stunning, the most attractive man I have seen in all my life, and exactly the sort of man who appears as the hero in all my books. David and Emma became the 11th Duke and Duchess of Rutland, and tradition called for them to move into the castle. The new Duchess quickly rolled up her sleeves and took the reins of the estate. "I had to get a hold of this monster and make it work," she explains. "It's a great big machine." She quickly laid off about half of the 350-person staff and began to make a brand out of Belvoir, with herself as its very successful face. Now a regular on lecture circuits, she recently published her third book on the estate, Capability Brown and Belvoir, about the great landscape architect's work on site, and has launched myriad product lines, from furniture and fabrics to shotguns. The over and under 12-bore Rutland is stamped with the Duchess's logo. In the process, she has reinvigorated the property. At so many of these stately homes, they carry on in the same grim old way, says Lord Harry Dalmany, chairman of Sotheby's UK and Ireland. Bold as brass, Emma has made it look like it might actually be fun to live in a house like this. And her daughters are so unlike those posh, bloodless girls who complain and don't want to do anything. They're the dictionary definition of work hard, play hard. They're fireballs. Next photos, triple players. Alice, Violet, and Eliza in the pre-guard room. And Violet, Eliza, and Alice at Eliza's 18th birthday party. "Obviously, it's not going to be a normal childhood," says Lady Violet, as we sit down for a chat with her sisters. "When we moved in here, it was pretty terrifying. For anyone, it would have been scary, but to an 8-year-old, it was quite daunting. It took 7 minutes, fast walking, to get from her bedroom to the front door, which involved passing through vast chambers, decorated with enough menacing swords, muskets, and cannons to wage any battle. But soon enough, the girls discovered there were advantages to living in a castle, like being able to scare the tourist. We had some real laughs. So much fun being really naughty," says Violet, as she recalls some of their youthful hijinks, such as hiding under the enormous four-poster bed in the room Queen Victoria slept in. When a group of tourists passed by with a guide, the sisters would suddenly shoot their hands out from underneath the bed, making some tourists jump in fright, and earning the girls a bollocking, as Violet puts it, from the guides once the tourists had left the room. Another favorite pastime was to shoot paper darts down from the upper gallery of the chapel. "It certainly made it interesting for them," says Eliza, referring to the unsuspecting visitors. Their fun and games weren't incompatible with entrepreneurship. There were many opportunities at the castle to supplement their allowances, they discovered, from inviting young visitors to take a ride in their miniature electric cars for 50p, to flogging, according to Alice, their old toys on the lawn. Eliza helped man the little gift shop, selling postcards and souvenirs. "I said, right, how many hours do I have to work to buy an iPod?" While Violet ran an ice cream shop. "My math wasn't brilliant," she confesses. "I wound up overcharging." Arithmetic aside, and contrary to expectations one has after reading their press clippings, the sisters possess a strong work ethic, which goes hand in glove, as it were, with their social life. "It's the upstairs-downstairs thing," observes Eliza. "Mum always instilled in us that you can have as much fun as you like upstairs, but when we're downstairs, we have to work, to understand that this estate is a business, and we have to immerse ourselves in it." "We love nothing better than having a party," comments Alice. "Put us on a mountaintop or in a ballroom, we'll have a good time. But partying is not the be-all of our lives. We realize the value of work, not just money-wise, but mentally. It keeps you sane. It is part of our upbringing that we know how to have fun and party, but we know how to get up the next morning at 9 o'clock and go to work," says Violet. "I've never missed a day of work. Life is about getting the balance right." All three girls attended the posh, $39,000 per year, all-girls Queen Margaret's boarding school in York. Eliza is now entering her second year at Newcastle University, where she is studying business management and pursuing her interest in acting and singing. Her elder sisters skipped university. Violet, who has been employed at My Beautiful City, a creative agency in Soho, just started her own marketing and brand strategy consultancy. Alice, who attended the Condé Nast College of Fashion and Design, is a model, stylist, and personal shopper at Selfridges, and writes a fashion column in the Sunday Telegraph. A recent feature about her in the Telegraph headlined, "Why Lady Alice Manners is Fashion's New Name to Watch," called her supremely stylish. Though they have all left the nest, they come back to Belvoir most weekends. During the daytime, it's all about shooting and riding. The Belvoir Hunt, founded around 1730, is among the UK's toniest fox hunts. The Duke of Rutland's pack of purebred old English hounds, one of the last in England, is housed in the octagonal-roofed Belvoir Hunt kennels, designed by James Wyatt and built in 1804. But at night, watch out when they get things going and dada balls. The nightclub the Duchess installed in a subterranean space when she and the Duke moved in, equipped with a smoke machine, an elaborate lighting system, and turntables manned by rotating members of their gang. Otis Ferry, whom Alice is dating, spins frequently. "It's like Annabelle's in the country," explains Violet. "It turns into crazy, major fun, carnage." It's 18 to 80, local characters to members of the royal family all digging in, says communications advisor and family friend Joe Phelan. Bonkers. Party giving is a skill that Manners girls begin training for early on. Family tradition dictates that a major ball be held upon their 18th birthday. Each of us has micromanaged ours, says Eliza. Themes are required. For Eliza, it was the circus. The Duke and Duchess were top-hatted ringmasters. Violet chose gods and goddesses, while Alice picked Arabian Nights, for which her brothers, Charles, Marcus of Granby, and Lord Hugo, arrived on camels. 9-year-old Hugo wrote and performed a rap for the birthday girl. Alice, 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 she lives in a palace, palace, palace. Austin Powers was the theme Charles picked for his 18th in July. The Duke came as Dr. Evil, and a Jaguar XK8 was decorated in the Union flag. The girls opened up on the subject of their parents' separation and new domestic arrangements. It was tough initially, but now we couldn't be in a better place, says Violet. We go up to Dad's tower and hang out with him, and every weekend we all meet in the middle and have lunch or dinner together. Everyone is much happier now, says Alice. If anything, the new setup has made them closer. Mum and Dad are best friends. I hate it when people say something isn't normal. What's normal? Says Violet. This works for us. It's unbelievably amicable. It's an arrangement that many other people have. It's just that we live in a castle, and it's on a slightly more public scale. As proof of the cordiality, Bert is now a trustee of the estate. A father of 4 daughters, he owned an estate nearby until his divorce. One of England's top grouse shots, Bert is a premier sportsman. Webb, an art consultant, was brought up in Brazil and is a niece of Roberto Burle Marx, the Brazilian landscape architect. They are a great team. My dad understands and respects that Mom has this incredible business mind, says Eliza. Not always in life do things work out the way you want them to, says Emma. Everyone has a lot of healing to do when a marriage breaks down. This works in a very practical way. David and I share 5 wonderful children. We're great friends, and I've got a job to do here. I just think, get on with it. We may live in a historic building, but that's no reason to be bound by outmoded traditions. A bit later, I climb the stairs of the Shepherd's Tower for a visit with His Grace. He sits at an imposing mahogany table, a portrait by Van Dyck of Lady Catherine Manners, a daughter of the 6th Earl of Rutland, hanging behind him. He seems the picture of an old-school duke, portly, cigar-chomping, and unabashedly non-PC. Just a few days after the UK's Brexit vote, his conservatism is literally flying high. On the flagpole above the castle, he has had the colors of the U.S. Confederacy hoisted in place of the usual ducal flag. After voting for secession from the EU, I thought it was an appropriate flag to fly, he says. I bought it last year when I heard the South Carolina state legislature had voted to ban it. I thought, how very pathetic and very PC. It is historical. Leaving the European community has certainly given the EU a very large enema, he adds gleefully. Though the Duke doesn't come across as the bookish sort, he has spent the last decade at work on Resolution, a biography of the 4th Duke of Rutland and his brother, co-written with Emma Ellis and published last spring by Head of Zeus Books. I bash on with writing, and my wife Emma gets on with the estate, he says. She has a strong work ethic, as do my children, I'm glad to say. Unexpectedly, the Duke seems in many ways the most laid-back member of the household. I've lived here all my life, he notes. At a certain point in your life, you find yourself taking over. You just have to get on with it. That requires long-term thinking, this 11th-generation Duke adds. When I plant a tree, I think, what trees will look nice in 300 years? I take a 300-year view. During my lifetime, the family will be 1,000 years old. We will be here another 1,000 years. One can only wonder, What will the parties be like in 3017? This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Happy New Year!